Good evening. How's everyone doing? So this is Buddhism in a Nutshell, Session 5. I guess we have a couple of new people here. Couple?
Yeah, my name is Joel.
Hi, Joel. Welcome. And I guess a couple people in the back, too, are here for the first time. Okay. Well, so this is week number 5 of a 5-week class. Have you been to Kanapa Center before, the center at all?
When it was located at the other location.
Oh, okay. Okay. And have you all been here before? No? Okay. Well, this is the kind of class where you can just kind of jump in at any time. So just a reminder, if anybody has cell phones, turn them off or put them on, as we say here, put them on meditate. We'll start off, as we usually do, with a short meditation. So if you haven't done any kind of meditation before, just kind of sit comfortably with your back straight, feet on the floor. Don't worry too much about exactly how you're sitting, just in a comfortable position. If you do remember the 7-point meditation posture that we talked about, and you want to practice that and think about those different points, the important thing, again, is to have your back straight, and whether you're sitting on a cushion or in a chair, just in a comfortable position. Take a moment to think about your motivation for coming this evening. There's a lot of other things we could all be doing. Just give yourself some credit for choosing to be here for whatever reason. Think about how being here may be of benefit to yourself and to other beings as well. Try to extend that motivation out. Think about being the greatest possible benefit to all sentient beings. It's a very grand aspiration, but a very powerful one. Very powerful thought to have in your mind. So, this is a meditation we've done before, just counting your breath, very simple concentration meditation. Focusing your attention right at the tip of your nostrils. Noticing the sensations of the air passing the tip of your nostrils as you breathe in and out. Any sensation that you notice. Warmer sensation as you exhale, cooler as you inhale. You may have a tendency, it's pretty normal in the beginning, to feel like you're really breathing very intentionally. But as you practice this, try to let your breathing just settle into a natural pattern, not forced. Just allowing your breath to move naturally, allowing yourself to breathe normally. All you're doing is noticing. Sitting and noticing the movement of your breath right at the tip of your nostrils. And as you exhale, you can think out, if that helps you focus. As you inhale, count each breath. 1. Out. Inhale, 2. And see if you can count all the way to 10. While remaining completely focused on those sensations at the tip of your nose. And if distractions arise, as they so often do, maybe your attention is drawn away from your breath by a sound or a sensation in your body, or often by a thought, you find yourself thinking about something else. As soon as you're aware that you've become distracted, just gently, without any further conversation with yourself about it, rest your attention back on your breath at the tip of your nose and continue the meditation, starting over again, counting at one. Take a moment to dedicate the merit, any positive energy you've created by engaging in this meditation. Dedicate that to your benefit, the benefit of all beings, all sentient beings. So we have a guest with us tonight. This is Herb. Somebody got it. Herb's going to be helping us out tonight. So we've talked about some of the basic beliefs and practices in Tibetan Buddhism for the last 4 weeks. And, one important question to ask is, what's the point, right? Why are we doing all this? What's really the point of Buddhist practice and of all these beliefs? So who can answer that? Who can? Yes, sir.
To end suffering.
To end suffering? Good answer. Yes, sir.
To become a Buddha.
To become a Buddha. Okay. Yes. Calm mind.
Well, I would think that meditating and living a
life. Mm-hmm. The positive effects directly in your life from all the practices. Yeah. Yep. So that's it, basically. A couple different ways you could say it. One is you could say that the goal of what we're doing here is to develop the full potential of our minds, the full potential of the human mind. and specifically the full potential of the human mind to experience true and lasting happiness. That's what we're trying to do. Specifically by eliminating the causes of suffering from our minds and fully developing our virtuous qualities. And, you know, technically in Buddhism, the term for that is enlightenment or Buddhahood. And it's interesting to listen to some teachers, thinking Venerable Rabina in particular, and some other teachers, they say, you know, you don't have to get all holy about this, right? This is actually a very practical thing. And we tend to do that. You know, when we start engaging in spiritual pursuits, we do tend to think about them kind of abstractly. You know, we put them up on a pedestal or kind of think about them in a very detached way. But, you know, this is actually a very practical thing that we're talking about. So we talked about the Dharma, right? Which, does anybody remember what Dharma is? Does anybody remember that? Yes. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yep, exactly. It's a Sanskrit word, and it means that which holds or protects, specifically protects us from suffering. So one definition of Dharma, or one way you hear it used, is to refer to the teachings of the Buddha, or in a greater sense, a broader sense, to the realizations in the minds of enlightened beings, or the realizations that bring you to enlightenment, the experiences in your mind that help you achieve this. But it's also what we practice in life. So I was having a conversation with somebody after class last week, you know, and talking about, she was talking about a healer or a teacher she had been to, and they were discussing Mother Teresa and all of the, you know, absolutely wonderful things that Mother Teresa has done, helping the people in Calcutta, you know, these absolutely hopeless people. And this teacher or healer said, well, that's her Dharma, you know. And that's a perfectly good way to use the term Dharma. Lama Yeshe, who's the founder of this organization that we belong to, the FPMT, there's a great quote from him. He says, basically, Dharma is anything that causes our delusions, our disturbing thoughts to subside. It's anything that brings us peace of mind and liberation from confusion and suffering. So really, it's just as much what we practice in our everyday life, what we do in our everyday life, the very practical side of it. And this is something that you know, I mean, just about any teacher I've listened to really emphasizes. And it's emphasized in other traditions, too. You know, I mean, I grew up Catholic, and I remember, you know, at least every once in a while, a priest would say, it doesn't matter, you know, coming to church on Sundays isn't all that's important. What's really important is how you live your life during the week, too. You know, that also matters. That's something you hear, I think, in a lot of different religions. But we don't always get the message. I think that's a big part of the problem. You know, we don't always get the message. And there is that tendency to kind of distance yourself from your spiritual practice or like I said, get all holy about it, you know, and think it's something very abstract rather than something practical and concrete that you can use in your everyday life. Kadampa, the name of our center, what that actually refers to are a group of the followers of Lama Atisha, and they were considered practitioners who saw the Buddha's teachings as practical advice to be applied in your everyday life. So there's a long-standing tradition of that in Buddhism. And so, you know, we're not trying to convince people to become Buddhists here at any point. What it's really about is becoming a happier person, right? A kinder person, having a more peaceful mind, being able to be of greater benefit to other people. And that's really what it's about. And the thing is, in order to do this, though, we have to do this in kind of an indirect way, you know. That's why we have these tankas on the wall, not flowcharts, right? It'd be really nice if we just had nice flowcharts on the wall, right? How to become enlightened, right? Step one, step two, step three, and you just kind of study that for a while and you do it. And it sounds funny, but we do have that, right? Well, I've talked about the Lam Rim. Does anybody remember what the Lam Rim is? Anything about that? Yeah. The Path to Enlightenment, the graduated Path to Enlightenment, right? And it's an actual set of books. There's Liberation in the Palm of Your Hand or the Lam Rim Chenmo. And it's all written out there, right? Somebody who studied these books would tell you it is all written out there, everything you need to know to reach enlightenment. There's teachings every Wednesday, right? Geshe Gelug gives a teaching right here, how to get enlightened step by step, right? And it's not just kind of a witty title. That's the subject of it, the Lam Rim. So we have this all written out step by step. And, you know, you think about it, we should be able to just read these books or listen to these teachings and follow the advice step by step and get enlightened, right? Have enough time to do your laundry before you go to bed. You know, it should be that simple. But the problem we have is we're trying to work on our minds with our minds, right? And that's really what's at issue here and what makes this so challenging. It's like you're trying to give your car a tune-up or fix the transmission or change a flat tire while you're driving 70 miles an hour down I-40. You know, that's what we're doing. We're working on our minds with our minds. So that's why we kind of have to do things in an indirect way. That's why we have all this visual imagery and these prayers, these mantras, these readings, these teachings that we study. And that's really what it's all about and why we're doing things this way. It's to develop these realizations, these actual, not just reading the words and getting intellectual understanding, but getting a realization, an experience of these concepts in your mind. So there's a saying that just like a bird needs two wings to fly, we actually need two wings to reach enlightenment. And we talk about these as compassion and wisdom. Those are the two wings of enlightenment. So we talked about compassion last week. Does anybody remember the definition of compassion, the Buddhist definition of compassion? Yes.
Not wish suffering upon others, or want other people to be free from suffering.
That is exactly it. Yep. Compassion, the Buddhist definition of compassion, is the wish that someone be free from suffering. So that someone could be you, it could be a specific person, it could be a group of people. We even talk about immeasurable compassion, right? There's a prayer we say on Sundays called the Four Immeasurables. And one of the lines that it represents immeasurable compassion. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. So we also take it a step further and we talk about bodhicitta. And this is one of the, what we call the, one of the three principal aspects of the path to enlightenment. And bodhicitta, it's a little bit longer definition. I don't know if anybody remembers it, but it's the altruistic determination to achieve full enlightenment in order to free all sentient beings from suffering and bring them to enlightenment. So the altruistic determination, it's taking responsibility yourself, saying, I want to achieve full enlightenment so that I can end my suffering and also help others end their suffering and bring them to full enlightenment. So a very, very powerful extension of compassion, a very powerful state of mind, very motivating state of mind. And when we say we're trying to free all sentient beings from suffering, or we wish that all sentient beings be free from suffering, this brings us to the concept of equanimity, which was kind of the point of the meditation we did at the end of class last week, where we kind of challenge our notion, the way that we tend to view other people or value other people based on what they do for us. We view people as friends because they make us feel good or they do nice things for us. We view people as enemies if they've done something to offend us. And then we have other people that we look at as just strangers because they haven't done anything for us or against us. So they're just kind of in the background like wallpaper. So when we talk about compassion, when we talk about bodhicitta, a really important aspect of this is not discriminating against people based on our own likes and dislikes. Right. It's that. Now we certainly can say, hey, I don't want to be around that person because I know that they're just not somebody I need to be around for whatever reason, because I get mad when I'm around them or because they want to go out drinking all the time and I don't do that anymore, you know, whatever reason, or, you know, they're just a hoodlum. So we can certainly make decisions about what we decide to do in our lives and how we relate to other people, but it's having that equal compassion for everyone, recognizing that everyone is equal in their desire to be free from suffering and equally deserving of being free from suffering. So compassion plays a very crucial role, especially in Mahayana Buddhism. We're not being selfish by seeking true happiness. It's not a selfish thing. It's what's going to allow us to be of greatest service to others and greatest benefit to others. And it keeps us motivated to do that. Teachers, there are some teachers that say, you know, once you really understand how much you are suffering, you really get an appreciation for your own suffering and develop compassion, the wish to end that suffering, and then be able to look around and you can see the same suffering in others. And that's where you start really developing compassion and bodhicitta. So this evening we're going to talk about the other wing. We talked about compassion, you know, a little bit last week. We're going to talk about this other wing, which is wisdom. And get very specific about wisdom. But I want to mention a couple of other things first. So if you go to the website, the Kadampa Center, kadampa-center.org, and you go to spiritual program, Buddhism in a Nutshell, I mentioned this before, but you can download a whole set of handouts for this class. And it has some of the meditations that we've already done. It has some other meditations that we haven't actually done in the class, but they're additional ones, and some additional readings for this class. And one of the handouts is a prayer. It's called The Foundation of All Good Qualities by Lama Tsongkhapa. And so this is a Lam Rim prayer. It actually relates directly to this, or and reflects directly this graduated path to enlightenment. And it's used as a glance meditation. And what that means is you can read this prayer line by line. And you'll see, if you do that, you'll see that it talks, you know, directly. It's almost like an outline for this class, basically. Understanding that one of the lines is understanding that this precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once is greatly meaningful and is difficult to find again. So we talked about, you know, the Buddhist concept of rebirth. Talks about karma. Samsaric pleasures as the door to suffering, developing bodhicitta, morality. So, you know, these are all lines that you can read in this poem, and that's what people will do, this prayer. People will read the prayer line by line and then reflect on other things that they've read or other teachings they've heard that discuss these same topics. So when you read this, the first line, and this is kind of interesting for some people. The first line is, the foundation of all good qualities is the kind and venerable guru. Correct devotion to him is the root of the path. What does that mean? What's this guru stuff all about? And it's something I just wanted to mention because it is a really important topic in Buddhism. It's something I definitely want to discuss. So guru is it's a Sanskrit word. The Tibetan word is lama. And the definition is a spiritual guide or teacher, one who shows a disciple the path to liberation and enlightenment. So the word guru in Sanskrit, or lama in Tibetan, literally means heavy. So heavy with knowledge of the Dharma, or heavy with virtuous qualities, sublime qualities. That's the literal translation. So in some countries like India, you know, having a guru is no big deal. If you go to Discovering Buddhism, the Monday night classes right now, they're being taught by Shankar Mitra, who's one of our center members. He's on our board of directors. He grew up in India. And he was just saying last night, you know, that's actually the topic of the Discovering Buddhism module right now, how to relate to a spiritual teacher or what a guru is. And he was saying that, you know, in India, having a guru is no big deal, right? His parents had a guru and, you know, they used to go see him every couple months or something like that. It's a little different in this country, though, you know. I mean, I'm sure a lot of us can imagine going up to a friend or a family member and saying, oh, yeah, you know, I was talking to my guru yesterday. And you can imagine that friend or family member looking at you and going, oh, so you've joined a cult, right? Because that's kind of what we think of. And it's interesting because we have some interesting ideas, I think, or an interesting attitude about teachers in the West. And we don't always realize this. I don't always think we think about it. But, you know, if you're in middle school, right, and you're the kid, you're in middle school, right? And so we have an expert. Good. Very fortunate. So, you know, if I was a kid who was always very respectful and admiring of my teachers, very dedicated to my teachers, always following their advice, always expressing a lot of gratitude towards them, talking to my friends about how great the teachers are, am I going to be a really popular kid in school? No. Teacher's pet, right? And, you know, we don't always think about it, but I think we carry this kind of middle school attitude on in our life as adults, you know. Oh, teacher's pet, you know. It's the way we relate to as parents sometimes, the way we relate as workers, right? You know, we're working in an office. We're all working in some division of the, you know, Wake County Widget Company. And we have some poor guy who's the manager, right? And he's just got this job, and he's like the rest of us, doing the best he can, the way he knows how, sometimes messing it up, sometimes not. And of course, what do we all do, right? Every chance we get, we make fun of him, right? Stand around the water cooler or go and hang out after work and make fun of the boss, right? And that's kind of our attitude we have towards teachers, or, and we carry that over, I think, into authority figures. We don't always think about it that way. But there's a different attitude in other countries, in other places. I had an instructor one time from Korea, and he remembers he said one time that in Korea, the most respected people, the most honored people, are parents and teachers. Parents because they give you life, and teachers because they show you what to do with it. And I thought that was a really interesting, you know, interesting way of looking at things. So, you know, again, in this country, we kind of have a different attitude towards teachers in general. And then you say guru, and, you know, some people get this idea of this kind of sketchy character who's maybe not always having his students' best interests in mind. But again, it's something very different in other countries, and it means something very different in Tibetan Buddhism. And I think a good way to understand it, just kind of to get a basic introductory understanding to it, is think about the way that really excellent coaches are viewed by their players. Think about a basketball coach, football coach, gymnastics coach, really top-level coach. And you know, if you ever heard the way their players talk about them, the admiration they have, the gratitude, the respect. You know, you have the athlete being interviewed after getting a gold medal in the Olympics saying, you know, I really owe this all to my coach. You know, I couldn't have done this without him. And, you know, things like that. They're really sincere about that, you know. Or have you ever been to one of those seminars by, like, really successful entrepreneurs give these seminars, or you watch them online or you read the books? If anybody's ever done that, what are one of the things that these very, very successful entrepreneurs always say is an important key to success? Can anybody think of something that relates to this? Yeah. Their coach, their mentor. Right? People, that's the word they use in business, right? Having a mentor, having a more experienced person to go to give them advice. It's a very, very, a lot of entrepreneurs that I've heard really place a lot of value on this and see it as their key to success. So you can think of those things in Western terms, and that very much, you know, is parallel, I think, in some ways to the Buddhist, Tibetan Buddhist concept of a guru. So it's a very important relationship in Tibetan Buddhism, and again, that's why we mention it. And part of the reason why it's so important is because, you know, we have books and teachings and these step-by-step guides, right? Liberation of the Palm of Your Hand, Lam Rim Chenmo. You can read it. It's all written right there on the page. But we have to know, we all have different minds and we all have different lives. And we have to know how to apply those teachings to our lives and to our minds. And that's what, just like, you know, an entrepreneur, a mentor can show someone how to apply their business knowledge or these different facts and figures and information, how to apply it to their particular business. A guru or a lama, a teacher, is there to show you how the teachings apply to your life and to your mind. And to kind of put this in perspective, one thing that maybe is a little bit of a relief to some people, but so the gurus in this tradition generally aren't out looking for followers. They're not, you know, out there looking for people to follow them necessarily. The people I've met and people I've heard about who, you know, would be qualified to be a guru or that people would consider their gurus, they tend to be, you know, that are qualified to be spiritual teachers, they tend to be the first people to say that this is something you have to consider very carefully. You know, looking at someone as your guru, as your teacher, is something that you have to take your time with. It's not something you should rush into. They'll say, you know, these people who are qualified to be teachers will say that it can take a very long time. Even the Buddha in some of his teachings said, you might go to a teacher and listen to this person's teaching for 12 years before you decide whether you want to take that person as your lama, as your guru, as your teacher. And there are specific qualities. There's, again, another one of these numbered lists that we have in Tibetan Buddhism. It's a list of 10 specific qualities that a teacher would have. And you can look that up and see what those qualities are. And there are also qualities that we need to develop ourselves, to prepare ourselves to have a positive relationship with a teacher or to even find a teacher. You know, they say you're really not going to have a hard time, you're going to have a hard time finding a teacher unless you develop these qualities. So we have our own work to do before we're even ready for this. And if you listen to Geshe Gelug, you know, his title here is our resident teacher. That's the official, you know, title we give him at Kadampa Center. But he's very careful to make a distinction between what he does here and the actual teacher relationship. So he describes himself as our virtuous friend or Dharma friend, someone who's here to talk to us about the Buddha's teachings and help explain them. But that is distinct from the actual teacher relationship. He's not up here saying, yes, I'm your teacher. He talks about his teacher very respectfully, Ken Rinpoche, who is the abbot of the Sarajay Monastery. So it talks about him very, very respectfully. But, you know, that's why you might hear people be very careful about how they use the term teacher here, because it does have a very, like many things in Buddhism, has a very specific meaning.
So does that mean if someone's seeking a teacher is that something that you have to seek elsewhere?
So when Geshe Gelug says that, you know, he's here teaching on Sundays, he's here teaching Wednesday nights, and in that capacity, he's making a distinction between what he's doing when he's sitting here on a Sunday talking to us and that actual more specific relationship that you would develop with a teacher. There are people here at Kadampa Center who consider Geshe Gelug their teacher and have developed that relationship with him, and you might certainly do that. And, you know, you might end up just coming here for a while and listening, and you know, the thing to do would be to come here for a while and listen to what he has to say and learn what those qualities of a teacher are and decide if you feel that he has those qualities and that you want to accept him personally. And that would be kind of a separate relationship from just coming here and listening on, you know, anybody can come here and listen on Sundays, right? So if you decide to study Buddhism more thoroughly, this is definitely a concept that you should take some time to learn about. And again, the Discovering Buddhism module that's going on right now, that's the subject of it, how to relate to a spiritual guide or spiritual teacher. And there are books about it too, and a lot of ways you can find out about it. So any other questions right now? Everybody remember the plant's name?
Herb.
That's Herb. So what we're going to talk about next is the third of the principal aspects to the path of, and the second wing of enlightenment, which is the wisdom of emptiness. So many people describe this as a difficult topic. You'll very often hear it described that way. And, you know, so it's a lot like a lot of other things we've talked about. It's not very easy or straightforward. It's not simple, but I think it's very interesting. And what I would say is, you know, when you hear people say things like that, like, oh, this is a really interesting topic, or people will say, well, you know, you actually have to be a fully enlightened Buddha to fully understand emptiness or to fully understand karma. You know, don't be dissuaded by that, or, you know, put up a barrier in your mind because of that. What they're just saying is, like, you know, my day job, I teach people how to use Microsoft Office, right? So if I was given a presentation on that, let's say I was going to show you how to, you know, apply a theme in PowerPoint to a PowerPoint presentation, right? So I could put up my little screen and plug my computer in and show you step by step how to do it and give you a little handout to take home with you. And you could go home and you should expect to be able to sit down at your computer and follow the steps and get the exact same results, right? So there are things, and we're used to a lot of things being that simple. Just, you know, show me what buttons to click. So when we talk about topics being difficult, what we're saying, again, we're talking about that indirectness, right? The fact that we're trying to use our minds to change our minds. So what people are saying is, don't expect to just, you know, pick this up right away and in a half-hour discussion know everything there is to know about this, right? What we do is kind of, you know, in a class like this, we're just kind of introduce the topic and talk about it a little bit. But these are topics that you really, if you want to learn about them, you really want to understand them, it takes a lot of study and meditation and hearing it different ways and thinking about it before you even start to get a little tiny, you know, tiny grasp of it, a little tiny, you know, taste of it. But, the topics are kind of interesting, so hopefully that keeps you going. But it's also important to remember, like, so emptiness is an English word, right? And we tend to have pre-existing ideas about or connotations that we already associate with the word. So you really need to set aside these words. Like I said, I don't know what the the Sanskrit word is shine, I think is the Sanskrit word for it. But if I said that, that doesn't really have a whole lot of meaning. So we use these English words to kind of give you a little bit of an idea of what we're talking about. But you do have to set aside your kind of preconceived notions or pre-existing connotations that you have associated with the word, because the way we're using it here isn't exactly the same as we use it in English. Like, so for example, when we talk about emptiness, it doesn't mean nothing is there or nothing exists. It's something a little different from that. What it actually means is, so some of the definitions of emptiness, an absence of inherent existence. That's one way it's described. So inherent existence is also intrinsic reality, concrete independent existence, existing from its own side. Those are all synonyms or synonymous with inherent existence. Absence of existing from its own side. So what does all that mean? What does it have to do with Herb over here? So this, when we're talking about emptiness, what we're talking about is the Buddhist view or description of how things actually exist. So karma is kind of the machinery of how the universe operates, how our experience operates. Emptiness is the state of how things exist. So inherent existence is a quality that we instinctively project on ourselves and everything we experience. When we talk about this, you know, existing from its own side, intrinsic inherent existence. So we believe and actively believe constantly that things do exist from their own side, independent of anything else, independent of parts, causes, and conditions, independent of our own mind experiencing them. And so this is something, as you might expect, that Buddhism is going to challenge, and that the Buddha kind of taught about differently than we normally experience it. So to kind of get warmed up a little bit, or a little bit of an idea of this, suppose I say the word ibu. Does that mean anything to anybody? Kind of sounds like a nonsense word. You know, maybe a bird, some kind of bird. Isn't that a bird? Ibu?
Emu.
Emu. Yeah.
Sorry.
It's okay. But that might be what you're thinking, right? So what if I say the word mother? It's a very different word. Yeah. Mother, right? You know, definitely some... That word has meaning, I'm sure, to everybody here. You know, maybe very warm, positive feelings, right? At least that's what you're going to say when they're sitting right there, right? Some of us, maybe not. You know, it depends on the relationship that we had with that person. But we definitely have a very strong... That word has very strong meaning, I'm sure, for everyone here. So what if I told you that in Indonesia, the word ibu means mother, right? So now if I say ibu, oh, ibu, okay, maybe you had this image in your head of this Indonesian woman holding a baby, you know, very beautiful image, right? So now that word has meaning. But 5 minutes ago, 2 minutes ago, it didn't. It was just a sound, right? So this is kind of interesting because we sit here and we talk and we use words and we act as if those words have some inherent meaning, right? You know, we're shocked when we say something and someone doesn't understand what we mean. You know, really. I mean, everything that I say makes perfect sense to me, right? So, and this is kind of starting to get your head around it a little bit, but, you know, if these words had any inherent intrinsic meaning, then you could say any word and everyone would understand what it meant. Right? Any word in any language. I'd said ibu, and everybody would have gone, oh, ibu, you know. Someone from Indonesia walks in and I say mother, and they would go, oh, ibu, you know. They would know what it meant. But, so this kind of challenges the idea, this assumption we walk around with that these meanings are somehow held in these words, or inherent in these words. So, what about Herb over here? So, Buddhism in a Nutshell book and the CD that comes with the book, Venerable Amy Miller gives kind of an interesting analogy, or when she starts talking about this, she talks about a car. So we're going to use Herb instead of the car, but it's kind of the same analogy. So if we point at this, right, so there's a plant here, right? That's a plant. Does everybody agree? There's a plant sitting here, okay?
Hello, Herb.
Hello, Herb. I'm pointing at the plant, right? But now, like with many things in Buddhism, as you may have gotten an idea, we're going to start getting very, very specific about this. And this is what gets really interesting when we start talking about emptiness, is we start getting very, very specific. Am I pointing at the plant?
Yes.
Okay. Actually, I'm pointing at a leaf on the plant. Actually, I'm pointing at a specific point on that leaf. Right? So that leaf that I'm pointing at, is that the plant? Actually, it's a leaf.
Part of the plant.
It's a part of the plant. Exactly. It's a part of the plant. It is the plant's leaf. So is plant in that leaf? Is what makes this a plant somehow contained in that leaf? Could you, if anybody was a botanist here, could they, you know, get out a microscope and put it up on the screen and show us where the plantness is inside that leaf? No. Well, yeah, chlorophyll is a part of the plant. Stems are a part of the plant. Roots, these are all parts of the plant. So we say, okay, you're pointing at these parts. And no one of those parts is actually the plant. That's why we say the plant's leaf, the plant's stems, the plant's roots. Because plant, we in our minds, is some kind of other thing that possesses these parts, right? So where is the plant, actually? We could say, okay, well, it's the collection. It's the whole collection of parts, right? All these parts together, that's what makes the plant. Okay? So when does it start being a plant, and when does it stop being a plant? If I started picking leaves off this, how many leaves could I take away and have it still be a plant? Right? How many leaves had to grow before it was a plant? So we kind of think, okay, yeah, well, it's the collection of parts, but is there anything about this specific collection of parts that makes it plant?
Not one thing.
No.
It's green and it has leaves, therefore it's plant.
Okay. It's green and it has leaves. Okay. So, this is green and has leaves. Is it a plant? Interesting. I'm not just being silly. So what's the plant's name? Okay, so this is where we start getting into the whole plant is the collection of parts thing. Now, what is herb? Is there anything in there or on there that contains the herbness? Right? Could somebody come up and show me exactly what is herb or where is herb in there? Okay. We would actually say that herb, kind of a simple way to understand this, right? Herb is just a label that I have placed on this plant. It's a name that I have placed on this plant.
So plant is a label.
Plant is a label. Okay. Now, plant is a more familiar label, right? We've probably been calling this a plant for a very long time. I didn't start calling this herb until tonight, but still, you can say, and that's a really kind of very astute observation. That's kind of getting right to the point. We could say, if you think about it a little bit, even though we're very used to thinking this way, when you really start breaking it down, plant is really, you could say, just a label that we place on this collection of parts. Okay? Just like herb is a label that we've placed on this collection of parts. And when we start talking about emptiness, what we're getting at is the idea that we do this with everything. Okay, a chair. Chair is really just a label that we've placed on that collection of parts. Okay, the equanimity meditation that we did last week kind of gives you the idea that things like friend, enemy, those are labels that we place. Now, the thing is, we don't experience it that way in our everyday lives. What we experience in our everyday lives is that this label, plant, or friend is coming from the side of that object, right? That's an inherent characteristic of that object. You know, when you see someone that, and that's your friend, everything that makes you think of that person as your friend seems to be coming from them, seems to be part, an inherent intrinsic part of what that person is. Have you ever had the experience, and this really blew my mind one time, this is way before I really started, you know, studying Buddhism or anything, but I was really amazed one time. So I had these two really good friends, right? And I was really amazed when I was talking to one of those friends and found out that he did not like this other person at all. Like, really did not like this other person. And I thought they were both absolutely fabulous people. It just blew my mind that I could think these were both great people and they wouldn't think the same thing about each other. Or what also blows your mind is when you there's somebody you really, really, really don't like that really gets on your last nerve, and your really good friend thinks they're wonderful. Right? And that just, you know. So these characteristics that we place, these labels that we place, the thing is that we mix the label with the thing. And we perceive these characteristics as coming from the side of that thing. We perceive this chair as being a chair from its own side, right? As having these, as is inherently, intrinsically being a chair. We don't perceive chair as just a label we're placing on a collection of parts. So what we're saying, again, when we talk about emptiness, we're saying that things actually lack this inherent, intrinsic existence that we perceive them as having, that this is actually just a hallucination. The idea that when we look at that plant, we say, oh, it's a plant. And the fact that it's a plant is just coming from its side is actually, when we talk about being deluded or a hallucination, this is what we're talking about. It's a very interesting thing. Now, it's very important to realize we're not saying that things don't exist. And that's how people, that's what we tend to do, right? Being human, you say, okay, well, it's not exactly as I perceive it, then that must mean it doesn't exist at all, right? We go off the other deep end. Things do exist, but they exist in a specific way. What the Buddha says is they exist in dependence. They are dependent arising. And what that means is they exist in dependence on their parts, right? Dependence on causes and conditions. So in order for this plant to be here, for this collection of parts to be here, a seed had to go in the ground and receive the correct amount of water and sunlight and grow and have oxygen to develop into a plant. Those are causes and conditions, right? So we have parts, we have causes and conditions. The third thing is we have a labeling mind or a designating consciousness. So the mind that labels this object. And when we talk about how things exist, we say it exists in dependence on these three things. Yes.
So would the same be said for people?
Yes. Nice segue into the next point, right? So this is just, and whether you, like I said, this is not something like a PowerPoint presentation on how to do this thing in Excel. You know, this is not something you're going to wrap your mind around it instantly. sorry. So this is the idea. When we say, how do things, yes, things do exist. They are dependent arisings. They exist in dependence on their parts. This plant exists in dependence on a collection of parts. Leaves, roots, stems, chlorophyll. They exist in dependence on causes and conditions. The causes and conditions that have come together to create this plant. And labeling mind, labeling consciousness. Yes?
So are
you can recognize that. Sure, I can sit here and recognize that, yep, there's a collection of parts there. What we see is that what we recognize as a plant, you know, we can sit here and intellectually say, yes, okay, I can see that a plant is a label I'm placing on this, just like herbs is a label that I'm placing on it. But that's not necessarily what our everyday experience is. That's not necessarily how we actually experience it. There's still our mind in there experiencing that everything we associate with plant is coming from the side of this. Yes. It's related, yeah, yeah. So this is how that change from moment to moment, right? And part of that hallucination is this sense of permanence, right, that we have. So where we really go overboard with this, and where we really, so the granddaddy of all illusions is how we view ourselves, right? Because we view ourselves as independently, inherently existing from our own sides. So Scott, right? Scott sitting here. So there is something, someone sitting here on this cushion, right? There is a collection of parts of blood, skin, bones, physical form, and mind, right? But are any of those bones Scott? Is the blood? No, they're bones. Is the blood Scott? No, it's blood. No, it's my mind. A mind that exists is parts, right? There are thoughts, memories, skills, abilities, perceptions, feelings, right? Other mental formations like karma. So there are parts, you know, just like we could break these leaves down into cells and chlorophyll and things like that. So in any one of those parts, in any particular thought, can you find Scott? Can you find the Scottness? Just like in any particular bone, can you find where is Scott there in that bone? We would say, no, there's a collection of parts, right, that have come into existence and that will exist for a certain amount of time and then will cease to exist. And on top of that collection of parts, we place a label, Scott. That seems very, very, very real to me, right? And I perceive, and this is the granddaddy of all hallucinations, is I perceive Scott as being independently existing. Not just a label on a collection of parts. I can sit here and say it, but that's not the way my mind perceives it. My mind perceives Scott as a very real phenomena, as real as my hands, as real as my legs, as real as my thoughts, that Scott is a very real phenomena, not just a concept. Yes.
So the next step beyond that is I used to study Zen.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the concept of connectedness, how all things are related together and connected.
There's a lot of ways that all things are connected, yep, and interrelated. Yep. Because the, you know, one way is that right now I'm perceiving me sitting over here and you sitting over there, and I'm everything that I perceive about you right now appears to me to be coming from you, from your own side, not merely a label that I'm placing on you, right? So just like I have labels that I'm placing on me, man, human, American, right? I'm placing those same labels on you. Right? Nice person. You seem like a nice person, right? You hear a Kadampa Center asking questions, coming to class. Nice person, same labels I like to place on myself. And those characteristics seem to be coming from you. I don't perceive them as my mind projecting those qualities on you. So that right there is one way that we're connected, right? The way we perceive things, that we're very, very connected in ways that we don't naturally perceive. So there is, and one way to think about it is there is something here with wrapping paper over it, right? So there is a plant here. There is a conventional object here, just like there is a collection of parts sitting here. But on top of that, what we call a conventional base, we lay this wrapper over top, and that wrapper is an illusion. The problem is that everything that we just perceive in our everyday lives, the way things are, is all that wrapper. We blend the wrapper with the object and we don't see them as separate things. We don't see the wrapper as a wrapper or a label. We see it as coming from that object. Yes?
What gets reborn? Is that your conscious mind?
There is a very subtle level of consciousness. Right, just like there is a mind, right, that's dependent on parts and causes and conditions and a designating consciousness, right? When I sit here and think about my thoughts or my memories, that's just another part of mind, another leaf on the plant that's recognizing this other leaf, right? And this gets a little, you know, you take some time to wrap your head around. But so there is a part of mind, an essence of mind, this very subtle level of consciousness that does persist and gets into another physical form, reborn in another physical form, but it's empty of inherent existence. It is a conventional base upon which we place characteristics, but it exists independence. Yes, and it exists independence. That's the important part of it, is even that subtle level of consciousness does not exist from its own side. It exists independence on its parts, on a previous moment of consciousness, right? It's causes and conditions, and on a labeling mind. Told you it was fun. So, how do we really, you know, so, like you said, how do things really exist? They exist independently. Interdependently, not independently, interdependently, changing from moment to moment, right? Not this, you know, permanent, always going to be there way we like to look at things, not what we see. So, you know, just the way we exist, we consist of a body and of a mind, thoughts, feelings, experiences, blood, skin. But on top of that, we add this label, or many, many labels. Man, woman, American, human, North Carolinian, right? Good, lazy, all these other things, all these other labels we add. Scott, right? Our identity. And so our ego grasps onto, and some of this I'm just going to kind of read from my notes I took of listening to Venerable Amy's lecture, but because she really, I think, puts some of this in a good way. Our ego grasps on to a fantasized stability and permanence of these labels. A fantasized stability and permanence of these labels. We like to think of things as just that's the way it is, and it's stable that way, and it is that way, and it's fixed that way, and it's going to be that way tomorrow, and it always was that way. When really our experience, when we sit and think about it a little bit, tells us that that's not the way things are. We invent a permanent, independent self. And this permanent, independent self is a hallucination. The problem, and now this is where we get into when we talked about suffering. And I've kind of mentioned this a few times and then kind of said, well, we'll talk about it on the last day. But like we talked about ignorance being one of the root delusions, the root causes of our suffering, wrong views being, well, more ignorant. This refers more to ignorance. Ignorance of reality, ignorance of the way things exist, is one of the root causes of our suffering. And so this fantasy we have of this stability and permanence of these labels, this label self especially, the reason this is viewed as the root cause, all other delusions, all other suffering springs from that. So all our interactions with reality are tainted by our belief in this hallucination. So when someone or something enhances this false self-image, we are attracted to them or attached to them, right? Somebody says something that makes me feel good, that boosts one of these, this image I have of one of these qualities. Oh yeah, Scott, you really are a very generous person. You know, that boosts this image that I have, this fantasy that I have of this lasting, permanent, inherent quality. And so I become attached to that or attracted to that. When someone or something harms this false self-image or challenges this false self-image, we experience aversion, the opposite of attachment. So when somebody says, you know, Scott, you're really kind of a cheapskate. You know, I mean, you talk about how I was being so generous and, oh, I gave this and I did that. But, you know, I mean, I've known you for 10 years. I think you're really cheap. You know, I get all mad. Now that person's not my friend anymore, right? I'm going to go unfriend them on Facebook, right? But that's what we do. And, you know, again, from the Buddhist view, what it comes down to at the very essence when you really drill it down is that these people that we don't like are harming this image we have, this self-image that we have that we cling to. So attachment and aversion are born from this root ignorance, from this ignorance we have of the way things exist. This ignorance which, rather than seeing things as dependent and temporary, we view things as independent, inherent, lasting, permanent, fixed, stable. And this ignorance is the source of all our attachment and aversion. And all the other non-virtuous mental states arise from that. Jealousy, remember the whole list we went down? We're saying, well, what's non-virtuous states of mind? Jealousy, anger, greed, all those arise from that attachment and aversion, which arises from that root delusion, that root ignorance, that image we cling to, that false image we cling to of Herb or of Scott. So to overcome these non-virtuous mental states, we must overcome this ignorance, right? And that's when we talk about liberation, nirvana, right? One of those steps on the way to enlightenment. when you liberate yourself from suffering. What they say, so I've been told, is that when you can directly perceive emptiness, when you directly perceive the way things exist, and you actually look at a plant and you see it as it exists, you recognize the label, not just intellectually, but that's how you experience things. When you have this direct realization of emptiness, that cuts the root of suffering. That cuts the root of all delusions. And that is what liberates us from suffering. So that's part of the reason why we focus on meditation and go to teachings and all this stuff that we do and all this imagery and all this symbolism. That's one of the big goals, is to cut this root delusion and to actually try to achieve a direct perception of emptiness. And some of the teachings tend to be divided. We talk about these two wings of enlightenment. So the teachings tend to be divided into teachings on compassion and teachings on wisdom, with those different goals, trying to help us develop our compassion, right? That desire, sincere desire to reach enlightenment for the benefit of others, and or the wish for others to be free from suffering, develop that bodhicitta, which comes from compassion. And then other teachings fall in the wisdom category, trying to help us understand how things actually exist, and they complement each other. So things do exist, and that's a really important thing to keep in mind, that things do exist. When we talk about this concept, we're just saying that things exist. Things do exist, but just not in the way that we, you know, naturally, spontaneously perceive them. We label things. We label, go outside and you see a car and you label it a car. You look at this and you label it a plant, because our karma causes us to experience things that way. And this is how karma relates. Our karma, the mind that we've created through our previous actions, is what causes us to experience things a certain way. You know, when we say that, you know, you go out and somebody says something that makes you really mad, and, you know, you go into work tomorrow and your boss chews you out, you know, and that makes you really mad, and you say, well, you know, that's karma I'm experiencing. What it actually means is that you have, through a past action, created a mind that perceives it that way. Boss, yelling, anger, mean words are empty of inherent existence. He is. And I'll get to the question in a second. So Venerable Rubina, as you can tell, a lot of people around here like Venerable Rubina. She gives a really good example. And she talks, you know, I can relate to this. She talks about studying martial arts. She was into studying martial arts for a long time. And she said, you know, when I was in martial arts class and sparring with someone, if they hit me, I would apologize for not getting out of the way. To me, it was training, right? It was my practice, you know. I not only would I, that's what I go there for, right? I would be all busted and bruised and my glasses are broken. And I'm not saying, oh, it's poor me, you know, he just hit me. No, I'd apologize for not getting out of the way. That's just a tradition, right? And so why is it any different when someone else hits us? Because we label it differently, because we have the karma to experience it differently. It's pretty heavy stuff. But when you really get to the full implications of it, you know, it's something to think about. Why we perceive things this way, and whether, you know, the idea, just kind of roll around in your head, the idea, and this is kind of the full implication of karma, is that what we're doing by creating these actions of body, speech, and mind is creating a mind, these imprints in our mind are creating the mind that experiences things in a certain way. Yes?
Thinking about the boss yelling, too, could also be my perception. He may not think he's yelling.
Sure, in a conventional way, and that kind of helps you loosen your grip on this idea. There's a lot of things we can think about in a very conventional way, very everyday way, I think, that help you. They're not exactly the same thing that we're talking about when we talk about emptiness and karma and everything, but they do kind of help you start to get a feel for it and at least loosen your grip on the other way of thinking. But yeah, you know, I mean, I've had that happen. I've gotten really upset, or people have come to me and said, you know, when you said this the other day, that really, you know, I really got offended by that. And I say, oh, I'm so sorry, you know, I didn't mean it that way. That's not what I meant at all. You know, have you ever had that happen? And you're so shocked that somebody was upset by that, because to you it just sounded like you were being really, really nice. But that's not what they heard. you know? So thinking about just very conventional, everyday things that we experience, you kind of start getting this idea that, you know, we perceive things a certain way, but other things aren't, other people aren't perceiving them the same way, you know? It's one thing that Robbie Watkins, he's our center director, and he leads a really good Discovering Buddhism module on emptiness on this. And one of the things he talks about is if things really did have an inherent intrinsic existence, existing from their own side, we wouldn't be able to interact with them the way we do. It would be totally contrary to our everyday experience, the way we actually experience things. Because if this plant was a plant from its own side, inherently existing as a plant, I wouldn't be able to tear it up, you know, turn it into something else. That's not a good example. I thought of it when I was having this conversation with Robbie. I thought of a really good example. I just can't think of it now. But just the way our perceptions about things changed. If Ibu had an inherent meaning, as soon as I said it, everyone in this room would have known what it meant. And that's kind of one of these indirect examples. But there's a lot of things when you start thinking about it that you kind of start to see that if they really did inherently, intrinsically exist from their own side, then we wouldn't, you know, you'd know what every word meant when you heard it.
Okay, what about a smile?
Mm-hmm.
So does that mean that it has intrinsic whateverness?
Mm-hmm. Have you ever, okay, so you and I are sitting in a room with Joel, right? And we're talking, and Joel is sitting there smiling just like he is now, right? And Joel leaves the room, and you say, oh, yeah, Joel is so nice. He's such a nice guy. He's always smiling. And I say, oh, he's such a phony. That's such a fake smile, you know? And what do you think? You're right. I'm wrong, right? As soon as you encounter someone that sees things differently than you do, I don't know. I'm not going to speak for you. I'm going to speak for me. As soon as I encounter someone who sees things differently than I do, my mind immediately says, oh, of course, they're wrong, right? That's what we do. But really, you know, in my mind, I might be seeing, Joel, I'm sorry to pick on you, but I might be seeing that smile as completely fake, as completely phony. I had this conversation with somebody. It was really interesting. I had this conversation with somebody not really long ago. Somebody I know who's just really super cheerful. One of those people that's just always upbeat, you know, even when things go wrong, they laugh about it. And what's that? Yes. It has been, not to me anymore, but it has been in the past. And I was talking to this person and saying, you know, I just always used to, when people were like that, I just always used to associate it with being phony. You know, and to me, like, people who were more serious seemed more sincere. And she said, oh, that's so funny, because to me, people who are really serious all the time just seem so pretentious. You know, like they're just not being themselves, they're trying to be something else. And, you know, I was just as serious about what I said as she was about what she said. And we just totally kind of thought about it for a while, like, oh, that's so funny, because this was our actual perception of it.
So does nothing have any intrinsic itness?
So you have to be careful. We're not talking about nihilism. We're not talking about the idea that nothing exists. It's nothing exists from its own side the way we perceive it existing.
Nothing
exists from its own side the way we perceive it. Everything is dependent. Everything is dependent. So that's kind of what you have to do, you know, and other people have a much better way of explaining this. But as soon as you start going, well, that means nothing really, before you even say exists or anything, just say it exists as a dependent arising. It exists dependent on other things, dependent on its parts, causes, and conditions, depending on my mind labeling it. As soon as your mind goes too far in that direction and says, oh, yes, it's really, then you have to go, but it's empty of inherent existence. And somewhere after playing ping pong like that, so I've been told, after you play ping pong with yourself like that long enough, you find the middle way of perceiving the way things exist. And not in either of those extremes, because that's what we do. We just flip back and forth between the extremes, even when we start getting an idea of this. Yes?
This is very serene, but you should not.
nothing is solid, which I thought, to me that's just been a really neat image to keep in mind.
Mm-hmm.
When I was feeling bad about myself, like, oh, I'm lazy, I'm this,
mm-hmm.
nothing is solid, or
mm-hmm.
this, oh, this person made me mad, or this happened, nothing is solid.
Yeah. Yeah. So if anybody didn't hear that, just what she was saying, she was reading from Pema Chodron. I don't know if she's exactly how to spell it. You may have pronounced it right, and I may be pronouncing it wrong, but she's a well-known Buddhist nun, writer, teacher. And the thing that you read that really clicked for you was nothing is solid. And this is, I think that it's a nice metaphor, and you will find this if you start studying, listening to teachers, reading books. Every once in a while, you're going to hear something that just clicks. You know, that's why there's a couple of things we say about teachers. One of the reasons we're so grateful to teachers is because they repeat things over and over again until we finally get it. You know, but another thing that you'll find is from listening, and this is one of the reasons why, you know, people will encourage you just, you know, read stuff outside of Buddhism. It doesn't have to all be within Buddhism. It doesn't all have to be within Mahayana Buddhism, within the Gelupa school of Tibetan Buddhism. Geshe Gelug talks about Mother Teresa all the time when he's talking about compassion. So you may find things from other traditions that really, where, you know, you're reading a book from, or reading the Bible, reading a book from another teacher, another tradition, and all of a sudden it clicks for you. But there are a lot of things like that where just one particular way of saying it is what works for you, you know? So anything else? Anyone else? Questions? Comments? Okay, you know what? Can you use the mic? I've been a slacker this evening and not asking people to use it. Chris is going to yell at me.
So where would that end? So I could look at this plug-in thing that you have and say, okay, well, that's his little plug-in for his computer. But really it's not, because there's wires in there. But wires are labeled too, so really
mm-hmm.
it's... metal. Metal's a label too, so really it's, I mean, how far can
really
that possibly
it's
go?
Atoms.
Okay. But is atom a label?
Stephen Hawking.
I mean, so at what point would you, as you say, be able to perceive everything as it actually is? I'm not scientific or smart enough to
mm-hmm.
know what every single part of a plant is or a wire is or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a comment about that, Chris?
You have to use the microphone.
Or else Scott will get mad at me. My wife says the best way to look at it is there's no partless parts.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, that's a good way to look at it. And is that a Western philosophy thing, or is that a Buddhist? Because partless part, I think, is... So, yeah, and this gets interesting when you look at some of the debates that have gone on, the scholarly, you know, these different scholars writing commentaries, and one school of Buddhism had this certain proposition, or another school had a different one. So I think there was one school of Buddhism that proposed this idea of a part or something, or a, you know, elementary particle. And then, but the idea is, in this school, is there are no partless parts. Everything is made of parts. That's why everything is inherent of is everything is empty of inherent existence, because that's one way of looking at it, is everything is made of parts. Everything is.
How is the mind made of parts?
Do you have thoughts? Do you have feelings? Do you have memories? Do you have some good jokes? You know, those are parts, right? And you could say, so, you know, what is a memory made of? Well, that memory is made up of individual, like if I'm remembering how to write, that's made up of individual letters that I remember. Those letters are made up of individual part, you know. So you can play with this a little bit and start breaking things down. But it's a good question to think. You know, and this could be a meditation to do, where you sit and you pick something that seems like, okay, well, the mind, how can that have parts? And then think about it for a while. You know, well, what could be the parts of the mind? Well, okay, I guess memories and thoughts. Okay, well, what are the parts of a thought? Well, it has a beginning, a middle, and an end, you know. And we talk about the 65 moments of mind in a single snap of the fingers. So what you perceive is just blah. I want to go to Bean Sprout and get some lo mein after, you know, just an impulse or an idea. Well, that's actually made up of individual presence. And this is interesting. It's something I know very, very little about, but some teachers can go into really great detail about the Tibetan Buddhist, I don't know if you want to call it psychology or, but the breakdown of actually how the mind works. Like they go into very, there are some texts that apparently go into really great detail about the actual mechanics and workings of the mind and what's actually happening when you look at something. You figure these guys have been sitting in caves for 20 years or more, 40 years, thinking about this, analyzing their own minds, going back and talking to their teachers and talking back and forth about it. And they've come up with some really amazing descriptions. I've heard some teachers just start to go into it in a little bit of detail, and I just sit there and just am amazed at what's actually going on in your mind when you look at a cup. You know, so and then that kind of gets into breaking it down into the parts. But the idea is that if you go, and this is why there are some of these conferences where modern physicists, neurologists, psychologists are sitting down with, it's Mind and Life Institute is one that you can look at. That's sponsored by the Dalai Lama. They sponsor these conferences where, you know, modern physicists and psychologists and neurologists are sitting down with Buddhist monks and talking about these things, you know, and finding some common ground. It's not like the monks are all going to, you know, leave the monastery and start working for, you know, university, and it's not like all the scientists are going to, you know, put on robes and start meditating, but there's a lot of common ground in just the way we look at things and you know, sharing ideas and building off of that. Yes? Oh. Thank you, Chris.
Wouldn't the lowest level for a sentient being be the lowest level of consciousness that is reborn? So it's different than the connector that, you know, a part is made up of a part.
Mm-hmm.
But for a sentient being, it would be that level of consciousness that's reborn.
The very subtle level of consciousness, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, exactly.
That's the three levels of consciousness, and that is the most subtle level, very subtle level.
But isn't that where it would end?
Which is made up of parts. The very subtle level of consciousness, you could look at it as a moment of mind, a moment of awareness, right? What is the mind? It's clear and knowing. So that moment of awareness is dependent on a previous moment of awareness, which is dependent on... It has no beginning. That's right. Beginningless, that's correct. There is no first cause, there is no partless part.
So if it's not the seed that's getting the sun and the water to become wheat,
mm-hmm. Where did the seed come from? Another plant. Yeah? Yeah? This is like it gets into the basic infinity. You start thinking about infinity, you know, you're laying up at night, you can't sleep, and, you know, looking at the ceiling, oh, well, what about infinity? You know, I don't know if anybody else does that. Anybody else do that? Sitting around the campfire with your friends, you know, and your teenagers, talking about, well, what about infinity, you know. But this, you know, you get, and this is kind of what it comes down to. The Buddha says, no, there's no beginning to mind. There's no first cause. There's no partless part. It's just all, you know, it all breaks down further. It is all dependent on something else. Everything is dependent on something else. And these are things that you do meditations on, you know. You know, you can sit and think of any particular object and say, okay, so this plant, you know, you can sit there and look at a plant and say, or a statue, you know, you might sit there and look at a Buddha statue or a flower and say, okay, there are parts here. I see the parts. There are causes and conditions, causes that have caused this to be here, conditions that have allowed it to be here. There is my mind labeling it. What else is there? And then try to see if anything else that you perceive doesn't fit into one of those categories. You know, that's an interesting meditation. And the reason you do concentration and breathing meditations is because after about 2 seconds of that, you'll be thinking about chocolate chip cookies, but that's why we concentrate first, try to develop concentration.
Every Buddhist joke I've ever heard now makes
it. Good. Good. Remember what I said? I think I said a few classes ago about watching The Matrix after studying Buddhism for a while. That gets really interesting. So, any other questions, comments about anything, too? You know, this is the last evening, yes. Me either. Yeah. And that's part of the problem is we're used to things having a beginning, right? This class has a beginning and an end. Summer has a beginning and an end. A year has a beginning and an end. You know, goldfish has a beginning and an end. We have a beginning and an end. So we are kind of, and we have the karma to see things that way. Our minds can't, you know, aren't developed enough to get this idea of things not having a beginning and an end. You know, infinity gets really hard to think about. If you're a Christian, you start trying to think about, well, you know, I can remember when I was growing up Catholic, trying to think about, well, so who made God? You know? And that's a very common, you know, there's whole probably books written about that. You know, it's a very difficult thing to wrap your head around, because it's not just, you know, intuitive to us. Yes. There is no creator. There's no first cause. The Buddha is not a creator. Oh, yeah, the Big Bang is fine. Yeah, I think His Holiness Dalai Lama said, you know, there's nothing wrong with you know, there's nothing in Buddhism that conflicts with the idea of the Big Bang. Just conflicts with the idea of one Big Bang. So what happened before the Big Bang? I mean, I'm sure people outside of Buddhism have talked about that. Well, you know, there was something before that, and, you know, a succession of Big Bangs, and the universe, you know, expands, and then contracts back into itself, and then keeps doing that. I don't think that's, like, strictly a Buddhist idea, but that would be what, you know, Buddhism would say is, yeah, sure, there was a Big Bang. There was that first moment, but then there was something before that, of course. Something smaller. Yeah. Yeah. Somebody have their hand up in the back? Okay. Well, I do want to take, just to kind of finish things up, as far as what's next, that's kind of, you know, I mean, and some people, yeah, this is really interesting, and, you know, I'm going to go do something else now. But if you are interested in, which is totally great, that's fabulous. If you're interested in continuing your study of Buddhism, I've mentioned this book, Buddhism in a Nutshell. And like I said, there's you know, it's, the readings are really interesting. They're readings from Lama Zopa Rinpoche and Lama Yeshe, who are the founders of the organization that we belong to, the FPMT, along with Venerable Amy Miller. And then the CD that comes with it has 10 hours of teachings, so 5 2-hour classes from Venerable Amy Miller, explaining some of the same basic rough outline that we had for this class, but going into much, much more detail about things. If you're specifically interested in meditation, this is a book you'll hear a lot of people recommend, How to Meditate by Kathleen McDonald. A lot of the meditations that we do in different classes here, like, you know, on Sunday mornings, Geshe Gelick has been teaching 9-round breathing, and that's in here. Other meditations that you might do in different classes are in here. And sometimes other people say, well, you know, I don't know about those two books, but, or, you know, okay, I've read those. What else? What's another good book? And a lot of times what I tell people is if you go out there in the library, or if you're a member, you can borrow books from the library, or if you want to, you know, buy a book here, and you see one that really appears to you, appeals to you, that's a great place to start. You know, there's not really any, a lot of times that's the best place to start is if there's a particular book out there that looks really interesting to you. That's great. As far as classes, we have Sunday teachings with Geshe Gelick. And those are kind of, we do a few prayers in the beginning, things like that, little meditation, and then usually he'll be talking about a specific topic or answering questions that people have submitted online or written down. There's Discovering Buddhism on Monday evenings, which is and, you know, some of this I've mentioned before, but Discovering Buddhism is a 2-year series of classes. There are 14 modules. Each module consists of 5 or 6 classes. And each module discusses a specific topic. So there's a module like right now on finding a spiritual teacher or relating to a spiritual teacher. There's a module on karma and rebirth. There's a module on emptiness, a module on meditation. So it takes some of the topics we've kind of skimmed over here and goes into much more detail about them. And then probably the next thing coming up in this, you know, our kind of ongoing series of introductions is Meditation 101. Do you know when that is, Chris? May 9th. People know. Faster than the internet. I was like, I have my computer here. I can look it up online. May 9th, Meditation 101 starts. That's a really interesting, especially if you're interested specifically in meditation, because they go into a lot, that's what it's about. They go into a lot more detail, different meditations, some discussion about, you know, meditations with discussion in between. It's not just an hour and a half of sitting here and meditating. So those are some great, and you know, again, any one of those is a great place to start. There's not really a right or wrong answer about what's next. It's whatever appeals to you or whatever you think is good. We have pujas. A lot of people ask about those. What is a puja? That's more of a ritual ceremony. You'll see we usually have several of those throughout the month. They're done for different purposes, like guru puja, to create the causes to find teachers. And what it is, you know, you come in and they do more like prayers and mantras, and sometimes they're in Tibetan. I think they're very beautiful. Very, very, you know, and you'll see all that. We set the gompa up a little bit differently, kind of two rows, people facing each other. And you can just sit right down and grab a book and try to follow along as best you can, or you can sit in the back and listen. You know, there's kind of no right or wrong. But they're kind of, I think they're really interesting because they are more a little bit of a traditional ceremony as opposed to a lot of the other stuff we do that's geared towards Westerners. Very, very few, if any, things that we do here have really any prerequisites. Like the Wednesday evening classes, the How to Get Enlightened Step by Step that Geshe Gelug teaches, they say those are a little more for advanced students just because they might talk about topics that, and they're not going to go into a lot of explanation about them. They're kind of things that everybody's heard before, but you know, I found them pretty accessible, even, you know, being a real super beginner like I am. So I don't think that anybody, you know, if you want to go to the Wednesday night classes, don't feel like you have to stay away. You know, you can certainly go and check them out and see what you think. You might decide that, no, that's a little bit too, you know, too ahead for me, or, you know, I want to do other stuff first, or you might enjoy those. But there are only a few things that we do where we say you really need to have this type of, you know, something first. This class is strictly for people who've had this before. There are a couple things we do that way. So that's kind of just a kind of very quick overview of, you know, if you are interested in continuing and studying more, those are things. Yes?
Do you know when the next module on Monday
is? So we just did the second week of Discovering Buddhism, how to relate to a spiritual guide. And I think Shanka said it's going to run 5 weeks, so we have 3 more weeks of that. And then usually there's a week in between. So it would be 4 or 5 weeks from now when it would begin. If you check online on the calendar, you'll see when the next one begins. Also, you can go online to our website and subscribe to the Yahoo group. And then they just send you emails telling you, you know, what's coming up in the next week or two. So that's another way to keep up. If it really, really bothers you to not start at the beginning, I would say, sure, wait until, you know, it'll be a year and a half from now when the next round starts. We're early enough in it right now. We've only done 3 or 4 modules. So if you jump in right now, you really haven't missed that much. I would say it's kind of tough to jump in towards the end, the last 2 or 3 modules, but certainly early now, you know, it takes you 2 years to go through the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Yep. So I just want to take a moment to finish up with a few things. Sandy, do you have an announcement?
I'm just going to make a better ask the announcement, but if you'd like me to wait till the end, I can do that.
Okay. Go ahead and do it now.
Well,
But if you found this to be a benefit, we hope that you would help to support so we can continue to offer these courses for free, continue to pay the lights and the mortgage and the air conditioning and the heat and everything else that we need. Again, we're virtually an all-volunteer organization, so anything that you give is greatly appreciated. We have donation boxes in the back here and also by the door, so anything that you give is appreciated so very, very much. Thank you very much.
And you can also donate online, right? Yes, through the website. And what, you know, what I think is pretty amazing, you know, we always say this just because we have to, right? We have to do the little commercial because we have to keep the lights on. But what is the thing that is really interesting, you know, and you might consider yourself really fortunate, is out of all the Western, so, you know, the FPMT, Foundation for the Preservation of the Mahayana Tradition, is a worldwide organization, and there are centers all over the U.S. and in Europe. From what I've been told, we're the only center in the West that doesn't actually charge for classes. We do it all on a donation basis. All the other FPMT centers in the West, from what I've been told, actually, if you want to come to Discovering Buddhism or something, it's $5 at the door or whatever.
Yeah,
so.
I think there's a couple of more centers that are trying this because it's working for us. Literally, we have been. I've been able to say that for years now, but I just found out that apparently a couple of other centers have been watching our success here, and so they're turning it into a generosity-only type of thing, which was done by Donna. As a Buddhist, or even somebody practicing some of these things, generosity is considered one of the six perfections. And so while we practice generosity to give, we're the ones that truly benefit. And so once you kind of start working with that, you can kind of understand it. But I think there's two or three other centers now that are giving this a try.
Good. Excellent. So, as we always do, take a moment to give yourself a pat on the back for being here. For whatever reason you decided to come here, whether it was just curiosity, or your friend drug you here, or just wanted to learn something new about something you've never had much experience with, or whether you really thought there might be some benefit to being here. Maybe you already had that altruistic motivation when you came here to learn how to improve your mind to be a benefit to yourself and others. Think about that motivation and take a moment to, just like putting the bookends, just like bookends, take a moment to dedicate any positive impressions that you have made on your mind, any benefits that you've achieved through being here, take a moment to dedicate those to others. And we think, again, a very powerful altruistic dedication, and hope that these merits of being here and what we've done will ripen in whatever way will be of greatest benefit to all sentient beings. So thank you all very much. Hopefully we'll see you around.